It does not diminish any jurisdiction of the state. The tribe would be exercising civil concurrent jurisdiction in limited situations.
New legislation that would give tribes greater authority over domestic violence and substance abuse crimes. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 6th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lingering questions after Don Young's staff says he's no longer being investigated by the Justice Department.
Because neither Mr. Young nor the Department of Justice will respond, we are filing a Freedom of Information request from the Department of Justice.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
New legislation introduced by Democratic Senator Mark Begich aims to help tribes and village communities in Alaska get more control over domestic violence, alcohol, and drug crimes. The Alaska Safe Families and Villages Act of 2010 would pick up some of the elements that were cut from the Tribal Law and Order Act that was passed in July. Begich says justice programs set up by tribes allows them to deal with family violence as well as substance abuse crimes.
They, within their communities, can have a better response and a better result in dealing with it on a much more localized level. And in these areas of substance abuse, as well as domestic violence, I think the state of Alaska has failed in how to go after this issue. So we have to try something different. And I think we crafted something that keeps away from the sovereignty debate and all that, at the same time allowing some better systems or new systems of justice that can actually go after this from a very community-based perspective.
A proposed amendment to the Tribal Law and Order Act that would have created a $50 million pilot project allowing greater tribal court authority within a community prompted a strongly worded letter of objection from the state. Department of Law attorney Rick Svobodny wrote the letter that said the project would threaten state sovereignty and would be litigated immediately. With changes, the proposal eventually gained the approval of the state but was cut after Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn threatened to scuttle the entire bill over the money for the Alaska project. Begich says the Alaska Safe Families and Villages Act attempts to address the high rates of crime in Alaska villages. He says he hopes more information about the chronic problem of crime in remote communities will help the bill gain support in Congress.
We have a lot of communities that are interested. I think we, again, avoid the great debate, which is the sovereignty issue, because this is not about sovereignty. It's about how do we improve the justice system for communities that are in desperate need of new tools where they can engage, and why would we not do that if it improves the communities and the livelihoods of people? And that's how I'm going to pitch it.
Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund in Anchorage. Landreth says Begich's legislation is leaps and bounds beyond earlier proposals and targets the issue of jurisdiction.
It does not diminish any jurisdiction of the state. The tribe would be exercising civil concurrent jurisdiction in limited situations only. So what it does is it holds up the state and then provides the local tribal communities with more authority to handle things in more remote areas. And that's why it's such a significant improvement. It is that it actually looks like it will solve a problem.
The problems are huge. Alaska Native women suffer rates of sexual assault that are 3.5 times higher than the national average. A 2006 report found 95% of all crimes committed in rural Alaska involved alcohol. There are at least 200 villages in rural Alaska, but only 71 village public safety officers, leaving many communities with no law enforcement presence and the prospect of possibly waiting days for state troopers to fly in to deal with criminals. The Alaska Safe Families and Villages demonstration project would have Department of Justice oversight. The program would select up to 9 tribes in Alaska to participate at a rate of 3 per year over a 3-year period. Selected tribes would stay in for 5 years. $250,000 per year would go to participating tribes to help support tribal court costs, training, equipment, and other expenses. NARF's Landreth says communities with active tribal courts would be able to choose what type of sanctions they would impose. The bill lays out lays those options out and can include fines, forfeitures, restraining orders, and emergency detention. She says although tribes throughout the state could apply for inclusion in the project, some immediately come to mind as good candidates.
Villages in Southeast, especially places like Cake, maybe Dillingham, Sitka, and then a lot of tribes in the TCC region, because that region does an excellent job of training and assisting its tribal courts, so they're actually very well developed. I think those are the two prime contenders for these kinds of projects.
Tanana Chiefs Conference in Interior Alaska has been working on ways of empowering tribal communities to handle the problems created by drug and alcohol abuse. Lisa Yeager is a tribal government specialist for TCC. She says TCC contributed to the planning and supports the bill.
I think we need to do something new in the state to help improve the collaborative efforts between the state and tribes to address rural justice. And I think that this is a step in that direction.
She says it appears the bill has enough checks and balances to put tribes and the state in a good position for dealing with drug and alcohol problems collaboratively. Calls to the State Department of Law for comment were not returned. Representative Don Young is dodging reporters' questions about a federal corruption probe. Last night at the Republican picnic in Anchorage, Young refused to elaborate on a press release from his office that said federal prosecutors have ended their investigation of him. This afternoon, his office again declined further comment on it. Young spent more than $1 million on legal defense. Earlier, Young had said he wouldn't comment because the investigation was ongoing. Now, his Republican primary election opponent says because the investigation is over, Young owes the public an explanation. During federal trials of former state legislators, former Vico Incorporated owner Bill Allen testified that he and his vice president, Rick Smith, made illegal campaign contributions to Young and footed the bill for fundraising pig roasts for him. But since that time, the prosecution team that worked with Allen has been pulled off the case by the Attorney General for withholding evidence from defendants' legal teams. In one highly publicized case, the conviction of former U.S. Senator Ted Stevens was reversed because of prosecutorial misconduct. Ever since then, the Justice Department has refused repeatedly to make any comments to the press about its corruption probe. Yesterday, Don Young's primary election opponent, communication executive Sheldon Fisher, also started pushing for answers from the Justice Department.
The Department of Justice has been in retreat ever since the prosecutorial misconduct in the Ted Stevens trial came to light. Mr. Young and his lawyers have used the process to avoid responding to questions on these matters. Because neither Mr. Young nor the Department of Justice will respond, today we are filing a Freedom of Information request from the Department of Justice.
Fisher admits that much of the information he seeks can probably be withheld by prosecutors under confidentiality exemptions. But he says there may be some correspondence with Congress that would have to be disclosed. That's because Congress specifically requested an investigation of one matter involving Young, the Coconut Road earmark, which is money for a highway interchange at Coconut Road in Florida that was somehow added to the massive federal transportation bill while it was in Young's Transportation Committee after it was passed. In other words, the earmark that was never voted on, and no one has ever explained how it got into the bill. Fisher said the time has come for that explanation.
The issue is that there's some ambiguity about exactly how the Coconut Road earmarks was inserted into the law after it had been passed by the House and the Senate. I think most members of Congress, as well as observers, believe that it was unconstitutional in the manner it was addressed, and I think it's incumbent upon Mr. Young to respond to that.
The Coconut Road interchange would have benefited a real estate executive who made a major campaign contribution to Young, but Young has said that was not the reason for the earmark. The winner of the Young-Fisher primary contest will face Democrat Harry Crawford, who has called Young a, quote, legislator for hire. Yesterday, Crawford said it's important to remember that the conclusion of the federal investigation of Young does not necessarily mean he is innocent.
That doesn't make him any less guilty. Just might mean that somebody may not be testifying now because they're already serving their jail sentence. I don't know.
Bill Allen has not been called upon to testify since his sentencing last October. A judge has ruled that evidence provided by Allen that was withheld from bribery defendant Pete Cott would not have been sufficient to change the jury's guilty verdict. A motion to reverse the verdict against former state representative Vic Horing for similar reasons involving Allen is still pending. Alaska Army National Guard soldiers from across the state will be deploying to Iraq next week. Soldiers of Bravo Company will be deployed for a year-long tour of duty. The deploying soldiers hail from Anchorage, Eagle River, Wasilla, Fairbanks, Bethel, Juneau, Haines, Quinnahock, and Kenai. The deployment will consist of about six soldiers from the YK Delta that are part of the Bravo Company. A departure ceremony is scheduled for Monday at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson at 3 p.m. From there, soldiers will head to Texas for pre-mobilization and validation training before leaving for Iraq. Still to come, the 40th anniversary of the Chugach State Park. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Chugach State Park is celebrating its 40th anniversary today. The massive chunk of land on the edge of Anchorage encompasses a 500,000 acres of glaciers, mountain peaks, and river valleys filled with wildlife. It was established thanks to a passionate group of Anchorage residents who love the outdoors. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
State Representative Sharon Cisna was part of an early group of activists that realized the area should be protected. She joined the citizen-led coalition that met in August of 1969 to figure out what should be included in a state park. They weren't thinking small.
All came to the same conclusion. It was really kind of an amazing thing. We had the big map of what had been surveyed and what was available for the states to select as a state park. And all of us finally came to the agreement. There was some arguing to begin with, but we all came to the agreement that what we wanted to go after was every single inch of it that we could.
The area they mapped out is now the third largest state park in the country. Cisna says the size of the park was not controversial in the state legislature, and the bill passed easily through the House and Senate in 1970. Pete Panarese was one of the first park rangers, starting in 1976. He had a 28-year career with the park and is now retired, but still serves on the Citizen Advisory Board. He says one thing that's changed over the years is the amount of visitors. The Glen Alps Trailhead used to be a small dirt parking lot. Panarese says despite dramatically expanded facilities there, visitors occasionally overwhelm the trailhead.
Any beautiful sunny day during berry season, the parking lot overflows out onto the street. And that creates a conflict between the local neighborhood and the park visitors, casting a whole lot of concern and problems for park management. Those types of situations will occur all along the park boundary as years progress.
Panery says figuring out how to minimize conflicts over park access and provide adequate facilities at trailheads will be a challenge in the years ahead. Still, he says Chugach State Park offers an incredible experience, especially considering how close it is to a major city. He says one of his favorite moments in the park came not too long ago when he was working on a maintenance project with a friend.
Dick and I, coming out of Eagle River in October a couple of years ago, saw a brown bear approaching us. And the brown bear was fishing in a stream, so its head was down and it wasn't paying as much attention. And right behind it was a wolf. And the wolf was circling back behind the brown bear and picking up on its leavings of the salmon that the bear would tear apart, eat, and then walk on. That was really neat.
And he says he loves that he can still escape into some areas of the park and hardly see another person, a wilderness experience that's getting harder to find these days. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Local schools in Alaska are slowly making improvements in meeting their adequate yearly progress, or AYP, basic standards. The Department of Education today showed that nearly 60% of the state's 505 schools met the No Child Left Behind standards, a net increase of 10 schools over last year's count. Eric McCormick is the Director of Assessment, Accountability, and Information Management for the department. He says Alaska schools have shown a positive trend, but not as steep a growth as they had hoped for. He says this year, the results show 77% of students passed the language test and 66% passed the math test.
For the next 4 years, out to 2013-2014, that rate goes up every year, and it goes up at a pretty steep rate till we hit the point of 100%, which was the aspirational goal back, you remember when No Child Left Behind was first enacted.
The AYP standard is a measurement of each school, but the state is working with them and local districts to help them improve. McCormick says much of the work comes by improving communications between failing schools and those that have shown success.
We want them to enable and get the words out, but we, cases where we don't have to, we don't want to dictate what they need to do. They know what's best for their kids. They know what's best for their schools. And if there are opportunities to get people together, we'll continue to do that. And like our Curriculum Alignment Institute, when we first started that, those are for schools that were primarily in intervention status, but we've expanded it and allowed other districts and schools to attend. We'd like to get everybody, but I don't think we have the capacity to help everybody yet.
Eric Fry, the department's information officer, points to a long list of sources available to local schools and districts, from new teacher training programs to mentoring to pre-kindergarten development.
When I talk about state initiatives, so often I'm talking about going to the districts themselves for the expertise and then rechanneling it to other districts. And we have our director of rural education for the first time in the state, who is working closely with the state system of support in struggling districts.
The federal No Child Left Behind Act, which initiated the standards-based reporting, has not yet been reauthorized. However, McCormick says the department is working a plan that presumes it will be in statute to meet the 2014 deadline. The Anchorage School District announced its adequate yearly progress report yesterday. As KSKA's Len Anderson reports, the results from Alaska's largest school district may have been higher than the state average, but the improvement pattern was much the same.
For Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como, the brightest spot in this year's AYP came from some of the district's most challenging schools.
We're particularly excited about some of the Title I schools who made adequate yearly progress this year.
Title I schools are those with a large percentage of students from economically disadvantaged families, and the schools receive special federal assistance. They also are subject to more federal scrutiny. There are more than 20 in the district, most on the elementary level. In the latest report, 8 Title I's made AYP for the first time, including the fairly new Alaska Native Cultural Charter School and Avail, an alternative high school program. And like the statewide pattern, overall academic scores were up.
Our scores are up for both language arts and math. We were, as you know, some of you will remember last year there was a dip in both and we were very disappointed. But our schools really looked at their results, looked at the data, and really focused on the language arts, reading and writing, and the math.
But the preliminary results for Anchorage's graduation rate show a 2% drop from the previous year, sliding from about 70% to a little more than 68%. 47 Anchorage schools met every one of AYP's 31 categories. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
Rain-swollen waters of the Matanuska River have caused serious erosion in some areas near Sutton, carving out 3 feet of riverbank a day and threatening properties, according to Matanuska Susitna Borough media contacts. The river is also chewing up a rock embankment constructed some years ago in the Butte area. Borough workers are monitoring both situations. Frankie Barker is a planner with the borough.
there's a lot of water in the river, and it's moving into a wider channel near the highway, and there's quite a few properties and homes along that stretch that have been losing property gradually over the years, and the last couple of weeks, a couple of them have really lost quite a bit.
She says so far one home has been severely damaged.
There's one that the river is right next to the house at this point, and part of the house fell in yesterday, part of the back porch section. Right next to the one that's under the most threat, there's a property with a lot of cars and debris, and some of those things are that property owner's needing to pull back.
About 20 threatened properties are in Sutton, sandwiched between the Glen Highway and the river. The glacial river is loaded with sediment that scours riverbanks and carves new channels. An especially wet July has added to the river's potential for destruction. The braided river has a wide bed, and the river itself travels from side to side from one year to another. The Borough and U.S. Geological Survey has teamed up on a mapping study to identify the erosion risk areas of the Matanuska. The Matanuska is a state river. Rigorous state and federal permit processes are required to build in it, so the Borough faces additional challenges in dealing with erosion.
We've done quite a few different projects over the years. Once the river starts eroding like it's doing right now, there's really not much you can do to stop it. Part of it is, you know, the kinds of rivers we have here are different from kinds in other places where, you know, they flood, they go up and down, but they don't go sideways as much like ours do, our glacial rivers. So people that may not have lived next to glacial rivers just don't know that they could be in trouble.
The borough's Matanuska River Management Plan comes up before the assembly later this month. The plan contains a request for more money for erosion projects. Currently, the borough has some funds to buy at-risk properties. The Alaska Supreme Court ruled today that state predator control programs conform to the sustained yield mandate for managing wildlife in Alaska's constitution. Today's decision affirms a lower court ruling in a case brought against the state by two environmental groups and an individual. The Alaska Wildlife Alliance, Defenders of Wildlife, and Ronald West contend the state game board failed to apply sustained yield when it approved bear and wolf control programs in 2006. The court decision says there's latitude in the sustained yield clause that permits wildlife managers to establish preferential uses. The court decision cites Fish and Game biologists' assertions that wolves and bears could recover to pre-control populations if killing programs cease. The decision rejected the Game Board's position that consideration of sustained yield is discretionary. One Anchorage couple has transformed a rundown lot in the UMed district into an urban farmstead that produces most of the food they eat. They call it permaculture. Michelle Terrio reports.
This one right here. Saskia Esslinger is showing me around her farm. During the summer months, she and her husband grow about 90% of the food they eat right here.
Yeah, so this is the third year for this strawberry patch, and I just cannot believe every other day I go out and pick it and I come back with this enormous bowl of strawberries, and it just blows me away. Like how wonderful and juicy they are. Here, we can try one.
It's not a 5-acre spread in Palmer. It's smack in the middle of Anchorage, in a neighborhood where yards are more likely to contain rusting car parts than vegetable gardens. But it's here that Esslinger and her husband Matt Oster have transformed a slightly larger than average corner lot into what they call the William Street Farmhouse, a working permaculture farm. It's the center of a small but growing back-to-the-land movement that's taking root in the middle of Alaska's largest city. Esslinger says that people don't realize the possibilities of urban farming.
I guess we're trying to teach people how to go back to the land and that it is possible and doable up here in Alaska, in Anchorage itself. You know, a lot of people think they need to move out to the countryside and get 5 acres in order to be sustainable. And we're trying to show that it's sustainable on more of an urban scale or a suburban scale.
Permaculture means working with what you've got.
Well, permaculture is basically a design system to help you design systems that work with nature instead of against it.
The farmstead is practically bursting with fruits and vegetables. Rhubarb, raspberries, kohlrabi, arugula, even cherries, hardy kiwis, quinoa, and an ancient grain called amaranth. There's even an insulated chicken coop that doubles as a greenhouse. The chickens help to keep the temperature up.
Girls, do you want to work?
They say that growing things like cherries and kiwis in Alaska is possible. You just have to experiment and find the right varieties. Plus, though Alaska's growing season is short, its days are long and pests are few. Much of what's grown can be canned or otherwise stored for winter. Oster says that all translates to a lot of food. That strawberry plant, they've harvested 40 pounds of fruit from it so far this year.
We overlook how abundant growing food on a small scale for ourselves can be.
The couple envisions an Anchorage dotted with such farms. That vision isn't just about sustainability, they say. It's about security, too.
Alaska's emergency food supply is located in Portland, Oregon. So if there's a tragedy and for some reason they can't get that food up here, we're really stuck. We're really stuck. And the more we can provide our own food, the safer we're going to be if there is some sort of tragedy.
Esslinger and Oster have a business called Red Edge Design, which offers to design and even build food-producing urban farms for clients. The William Street Farmhouse is their best example of what that can look like. They say the point is to build a local food network right in Anchorage. Esslinger says that could mean savings on many fronts.
If we can grow some of our own food right here in our backyard, we're saving on so many different fronts. You know, it's not just the money to buy the food, but it's also that we're getting a much higher quality product. And if all of Alaska could do it, then we could, I don't know, I think we could actually be self-sustainable in some ways. You know, maybe not with our, we might still need to get olive oil and stuff like that and coffee, but, you know, most of our food we can eat locally.
But for now, it's time to taste the fruits of their labor.
That is amazing.
In Anchorage, I'm Michelle Theriault.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson, Ellen Lockyer, and Michelle Theriault in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel and Annie Fite from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.